While preparing for the seminar, I read some of Dan's most current work, and it truly is very cutting edge and quite impressive. And it really comes as no surprise to me that several of his colleagues have told me that Dan is the most, or at least one of the most, or perhaps the most knowledgeable person in the country on the economic effects of child support on families. That's true, Dan. Three people told me that.
Thanks, Mom.
In addition to his impressive scholarly record, I think Dan brings a very special perspective to our seminar. He has served as a policy analyst on child support for the federal government. He's also been a consultant to the prestigious Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation. But you know, Dan, I read that impressive resume. I was very impressed by that last paragraph on your vita. And in addition to this distinguished scholarly and career and his work as a policy analyst, he's also served as the assistant executive director of a not-for-profit children's organization. He's been director of a self-help program, a social worker for child abuse and neglect investigations, and a caseworker for food stamp eligibility. So I think he brings with him some very interesting and varied perspectives that give us a special lens on child and family issues. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you our next speaker, Professor Daniel Meyer.
Thank you, Karen. My task is to talk about the economic impact of child support. I'm going to start with just an overview of poverty among single-parent families. Then we're going to talk most of my time about the impact of child support on mother-only families. And I'm going to close with some discussion, what the research says about the impact of child support on fathers. The first slide is a little bit different from the one that's in your packet. It shows poverty among families with children, and it shows a time trend from 1968 through 1993. This is national data. It's the most current data there is. What this shows is poverty rates for these families. The top row is mother-only families, and you see very high poverty rates, between 40 and 50%, that haven't really varied very much over the past 25 years, in spite of substantial changes in the child support system. The next row down shows father-only families. I'm only going to make a few comments about father-only families. That is where there's fathers and children. We know much less about this family type than about mother-only families. And you can see from this slide that their poverty status is not nearly as bad as mother-only families. It is, however, quite a bit worse than two-parent families, which is shown in the bottom series. So two-parent families, poverty rates of around 10%, father-only families around 22%, mother-only families, 46, 47%. This rate among mother-only families, however, masks quite a bit of diversity, and one of the main areas in which they're different is bimarital status. The next slide shows in 1991 poverty rates for mother-only families where the mother was remarried but still eligible for child support because she still had children with her from a previous union, divorced, separated, and never married. And you see that the remarried mothers, the first bar, only about 10 to 12% are poor, rising for divorced moms about 30%, and for separated and never married, over 50% of these families are poor, according to the official government poverty definition. That sets the stage. It's partly why we're concerned about child support, because the economic status of single-parent families is so seriously vulnerable. Okay, now I want to shift to talk about the impact of child support on mother-only families. I'm going to divide my comments between different parts of the child support process. So first, you have to have a child support order. Secondly, we'll look at the amount of that order. And then third, we'll look at compliance with that order, the percent of that order that is paid. We've had policy attention at both the state and federal level. on each of those parts of the process. We've talked most so far about the guidelines, which affect the middle level, the amount of the order, but we also talked some about withholding, which affects, of course, compliance, payments, the last step. There have been substantial changes in paternity as well, which affects the first step, whether there is an order or not. Now, next overhead. This shows the national data on what percent of custodial mother families have child support orders. You probably can't read the bars, so I'm going to start at the left and work my way over. The first bar is married, so this is the remarried women who have kids from a previous union. 70% of them have a current child support order. Divorced, it's a little higher, 72, 73%. Separated, quite a bit lower, between 40 and 50%, but some of those are cases that are in process, will become divorced, are likely to have an order within the next year. And the last bar is never married, which here is about 27% of them have child support orders. This looks very low compared to the other groups, but actually this percentage has been rising rapidly. 1979 number nationally was 11%. So we've more than doubled the percent of never married mothers who have child support order. So this is a paternity issue. There's been substantial progress over time, but it's still much lower than the rates for the other groups. The Wisconsin data looks better, somewhat different and better than this. In terms of recent divorces, about 85% have child support orders, divorces with children. And when paternity is established, between 80 and 85% have child support orders as well. So we don't, the data on women who don't get paternity established is not very good. But once paternity establishment is made, the likelihood of having a child support order is fairly high in Wisconsin in the most recent data. Step number two then is the level of orders. The national data, which I won't show you here, shows some decline in average child support orders over time. And it's something of a mystery because we've instituted these guidelines that we thought were going to increase orders. One explanation is that the composition of the caseload is changing so that we have many, the never married group is growing the most rapidly. That's also the group with the lowest orders. So average orders seem to be actually coming down, but it's partly a problem with the kinds of cases that are being seen rather than the effectiveness of the system. Nonetheless, average orders today are lower nationally than they were 10 years ago. The Wisconsin data shows essentially flat orders once you take inflation into account, so that the initial order that's set is basically about the same today as it was 10 years ago. Actually, not today. The most recent data we have is from 91. So in 91 as compared to 81. Numbers are about roughly $4,000 in the average divorce, $4,000 a year of a child support order, and roughly $1,500 in a paternity case. What guidelines did was not so much in Wisconsin, was not so much increase the average order. What they did was rationalize the system so that the variance in order amounts for similar kinds of cases decreased substantially. So two cases that are similar in income now are much more likely to have the same order than they were in the past. But the average order amount itself has not increased dramatically. Third step then is, okay, now we have an order in place. Is that order paid? What's compliance with the order? The national data shows a very consistent pattern over the last 15 years. When there's an order in place, about half the time it's paid in full, about a quarter of the time it's paid in part, and about a quarter of the time nothing is paid. Wisconsin data is relatively similar to that rule of thumb. We do have some recent sort of hot off the press works What we've just done here is looked at divorce and paternity cases and looked at the first year of their child support order and then their second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year to see what if payments are sort of drifting from full down to none, which is, I think, a common perception. And actually, this data doesn't show that story at all. The top row is the share of divorce cases that are paying in full. And it's 55% the first year and actually rises over time to roughly 65% in year five. So an increasing share of divorce cases with full compliance over the 5 years of the case. Could be because enforcement kicks in when compliance is low, and so we're seeing some effects of enforcement. There is some research that shows that enforcement tools do make a difference. Could also be because income changes and makes it easier to pay. And this, we don't yet know the answer to that question. The other bars on here, second bar down, line, I guess that is paternity full payments. And here you don't see this increase over time. You see pretty much a flat between 30 and 40% paying full. So payment patterns, even though orders are lower, the percent who are paying in full is quite a bit lower. The bottom two then show that the percent that are paying nothing, and among paternity cases, that's the darkest row, increases over time, consistent with the story that we most of us believe. And the bottom line shows the percent of divorce cases that are paying nothing, and it is going up slightly, but only slightly. So the story from this most recent research is that compliance in Wisconsin is not falling off over time among divorce cases. There does seem to be some trend in paternity cases towards moving towards zero payment. Well, put this all together, whether or not you have an order, if you do have an order, the amount of that order, whether that order changes over time, and whether that order is paid, what's kind of the bottom line in terms of the effect of child support on mother-only families? Next slide. This slide uses the national data and looks at a time trend between 1979 and 1994. It looks at single mother families and says, let's look at their income before we add in child support. Are they poor or are they not poor? And then let's add child support and see if child support is enough to move a poor mom out of poverty and make her non-poor. The first bar in each set shows the percent that are pulled out of poverty by child support. And you can see that maybe some trend over the years, but basically this is a pretty small number, 5, 6, 7% of moms who were poor before child support are pulled out of poverty by child support. The second bar shows the poverty gap. Poverty gap is just the distance between the poverty line and actual income for someone who's poor. Child support may be increasing incomes among poor families, even if it's not quite enough to get them out of poverty. So that would show as a decline in the poverty gap. And so the second bar shows that the gap is shrunk between right around 8% up to 10, 12% by child support. Poor families before child support have a poverty gap, and that gap shrinks slightly after child support is paid. Next slide. This is also national data, and we're going to look just at the first bar first. It shows income among custodial mothers, and the bottom part of that, the first bar just shows women who actually received some child support in 1991. Their income before child support was Average income, roughly $15,000. Child support added about $3,000 to that. So about 17% of her income package comes from child support. You might note in the briefing packet that it's quite a bit different for divorced and never married moms, as you'd expect based on everything that I've said so far. The other two bars here, second bar shows women who have a child support order but nothing is paid. So their average income is $14,000 some, and of course child support adds nothing by definition of their being in the bar. And the last bar shows women who don't even have an order, and so they're worse off to start with, and child support by definition cannot help them at all until they have a child support order. Let me turn now to some comments of the impact of child support on the person paying or supposed to pay child support, which is typically fathers. The concern here is that some of these men are already poor, and so expecting them to pay more may not be possible, or may be possible only with significant costs to their economic well-being. And if they have repartnered and maybe had new children, maybe all we're doing with child support at some level is sort of reshuffling poverty from kids who live with dad to, actually from kids who live with mom who are recipients, away from kids who live with dad who are now payers. So there's this concern about what's really happening to the dads, and are we expecting too much? Now, the first thing I need to say about this area is there's really much less research on this topic than on moms. We know just much more about how the child support system is working on the receiving end than we do on the paying end. There is now some research on this, and I want to share three separate findings with you from that research. And the first one, there's no slide on, is just to point out that there is a relationship between fathers' incomes and their likelihood of paying. Okay, the order adjusts for incomes, but even after the order is set, fathers with higher incomes are more likely to pay fully than fathers with low incomes. just a couple quick facts on that. The average amount paid among fathers with incomes less than $10,000 in Wisconsin is 51%. The average income for fathers with incomes between $30,000 and $40,000 is 85%. So payment rates much higher. Now, it's interesting to me that the average payment rate for fathers with incomes over $40,000 then goes down again to 80%. So there is a general pattern, more income, more likely to comply, paying a higher percentage, but it drops off at the top a little. One of the things we've looked at with the Wisconsin data is tried to look at people who aren't paying at all. There is a child support order, but they have paid nothing in the last year. What kind of incomes do they have? And if we see that they have really very low incomes, that may explain part of it. If they have higher incomes, then that may mean that the child support system is not working very well. Now I'm ready for the slide. This data is less than perfect because we've had to take income data from Wisconsin tax records, and some low-income men have incomes too low to file tax returns. Secondly, it's only fathers who are in-state, so there may be some bias there from that. But nonetheless, what we have here is if we look at people who have an order but pay nothing in the first whole year of their order, the first bar shows among divorce cases, and it shows that roughly a third of those, this is the bottom third up to the 30%, have annual incomes of less than $10,000. If you look at the top, it's roughly 30% who have incomes 30,000 and above. And a third then in the middle. The paternity bar looks just much different, with 70% having incomes less than 10,000. Now you can draw your own conclusions from this figure. My conclusion is that the child support system could be doing more among divorce cases. There is some slippage here. Some fathers with modest and even higher incomes that are paying nothing, even though there's an order. Among paternity cases, the non-payers are all fairly low, are mostly fairly low incomes, which is not to say that the child support system is doing a good job, but only to suggest that we could do a lot more effort and perhaps not see much more return in payments. The final question then, to sum it up for fathers, is if we look at fathers who would not be poor if they were paying nothing, how many of them become poor because of the child support that they pay? Now, this is turns out to be actually quite a difficult question to answer because of difficulties in identifying fathers who are supposed to be paying. Nonetheless, the slide shows the best numbers that we have, and it shows two different estimates of this because there is some uncertainty here. The first bar in each set shows the percent of fathers who are poor pre-child support. This is the last slide. You don't have to hold that up. And the second bar shows then the poverty rate after they pay child support. And you see that in the first estimate and the second estimate is a little higher poverty rates in the 15% range. But in both scenarios, the percent of fathers who actually fall into poverty because of the child support they're paying is pretty small. You might compare this figure in your mind with the very first figure I showed, which showed the poverty rates among mothers with kids in the 40 to 50% range, and then poverty rates among fathers in the 10 to 20% range here. And I think that's, I can take a couple questions now. The question is, what percent of cases utilize withholding from the wages? Apparently, if there is a withholding order, either it's not working or there is no order if we end up with zero payments. The question is it permissive or required to have a withholding order? It is required. There is a provision in the national legislation that lets you opt out of this, but the basic story is it's required. The data that we have in Wisconsin shows a withholding order in roughly 80% of the cases. Now, some of that 20% are self-employed, where it's very difficult. Some of the 20% are cases without any income at the moment. There is, however, a significant cross-county variation in the use of withholding. And now that could be because of differences in counties and the percent who are self-employed, or it could be because counties are actually implementing this differently. We also see county variation in the extent to which the guidelines are used, and county variation particularly in the extent to which counties use percentage expressed orders, as Kevin said earlier, versus flat fixed dollar orders. Another question? We have a comment and a question. The comment is that the payment over time data seems to suggest that people who are partial payers tend to stay that way and full payers tend to stay that way, and that current enforcement mechanisms typically take some time before they're, you have to be a non-payer for a while before the strongest enforcement measures take effect. And then is that the comment? Then the question is, should the enforcement techniques cut in more quickly? In some sense, that's a policy question here. The research answer to that, I believe, is that if we did that, payments would respond. There is a strong relationship between enforcement tools and subsequent payments.